one want a race to watch. My advice is on him to live.
Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance. Hello and welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney and broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers here with
Hensley.
This week we're looking at Chinese investment in Australia. 2016 was a record year and we have an all-star panel in to discuss what it means for our economy and for this country's future. Don't move anywhere. On the Money, the Australia-China Investment Special starts now. Well, the trade relationship between Australia and China is a constant theme in global economics, particularly on this program. However, a new report featuring collaborations from the Sydney University of Sydney Business School and KPMG finds that China foreign direct investment into Australia is at record levels and forecasts optimism for the long term. The highlights are plentiful, from record investment to residential and agricultural investment across the country. Chinese investment has reached a new level of ubiquity. Now, our show tonight is dedicated to finding out where the cash is going and how you, the consumer, can make the most of it. Joining us on the panel tonight is Professor James Lawrenson, the Deputy Director of the University of Technology Australia China Relations Institute. Welcome, James.
Good to be here.
Vic Edwards, a visiting fellow of the University of New South Wales Business School and former director of the Asia Pacific Financial Research Institute. Welcome, Vic.
Thank you very much.
Can you get a bit closer there?
Yes, certainly.
Thank you. And Professor Hans Hendrichke of the University of Sydney China Studies Centre and author of the new report, Demystifying Chinese Investment in Australia. Welcome, Professor Hendrichke.
Good evening.
Good evening. Chinese investment is in Australia is at an all-time high. Mining exports, 16.4% up on last year. Agriculture's gone over the $1 billion mark. Energy's up. Foreign Investment Review Board says real estate investment's up to $34 billion, which is four times that of the United States. So where's number two? There we go. Professor Hendrichke, on your report, Demystifying Chinese Investment in Australia, there's a forecast of a positive trend based on China's going out policy. What should we say about where and how Chinese investment trends are set to go?
Well, they're coming closer to us in the sense that Chinese investment used to go into mining for 10 years up to 2012, and that resulted in our mining boom or mining investment boom. And since 2012, Chinese investment has moved much closer to the everyday economy that people are related with, and that is in agriculture. It's going into healthcare. The biggest part is going into commercial real estate. That's not residential real estate. That's commercial real estate. That is building apartments, buying hotels, investing in tourism.
There's been a lot of hotel building, hasn't there?
Yes, that is linked, of course, to the Chinese tourist boom. So it's creating infrastructure.
I notice you nodding there, James Lawrenson. What you agree with all that?
Well, Chinese tourism numbers now are up to 1.2 million, and they spend a whole lot more than any other tourists from other countries. The average Chinese tourist per trip spends $8,600. The next in line, I think, is around $5,000-$6,000. So there's not only more of them, but they spend more while they're here.
I'm just wondering, we've seen quite a bit about Donald Trump recently. He has also got some interesting foreign policy on trade. policies there, and he hasn't actually done anything at the moment. But it seems that if things don't pan out with Korea, he may become a little bit more hawkish on trade. How is that? Is that going to upset the outlook for Australia?
Look, in a perverse way, there could actually be some benefits. We know we compete with the US in a lot of markets, including tourism and education. Just between you and me, I think Australia's education sector would actually be pretty happy. But look, the broader picture is we certainly don't want a worldwide trade war breaking out. China's our biggest trading partner by a long way. They buy $95 billion worth of our goods exports, $11 billion worth of services. That's a whole lot more than the US buys. So we don't want any negative impacts on China. If that transition gets derailed, then, you know, Australia will have some problems.
Yeah, because the danger is, you know, that US is China's biggest market. So if changes happen in their market, then the knock-on effects are into Australia with the supply of raw materials that we have.
It's a little bit like the second round effects of the global financial crisis, because many countries were not affected by the first round effects, which were caused by securitization and also the CMOs being created, etc. But the second round effects were that, you know, countries like the USA and many other countries of the EU, etc., had a recession. And, of course, China didn't do so well out of that. So they had a recession themselves to some extent. I think we have to watch out for whatever Trump does do, that it doesn't create that sort of situation again.
Yeah, and if we, you know, the danger, I guess, with having such a good customer in China is that we could get headwinds if there are changes to anything in international trade. Where could Australia look to take up the slack if this happens?
I think the problem is more political. We have been such a strong ally of the United States. We're the only country that has fought with them in every disputation that they've had globally. So they should regard us as being perhaps their best ally. But the problem we have now is that China is also our best trading partner. And with that, we have a problem in trying to be fair-handed between the two positions. If USA wants us to take a very strong position against China, I think we have to resist to some extent. We have to find a balance which will give us that future that will still be okay, because one of the reasons why we survived so well in the global financial crisis was that we basically were skating on the shirt sleeves of China. China had done very well with its industrial and its import-export situation, and we did very well, particularly out of mining, in that period.
Mm. So you're in belief that economic limbo is more, economic importance is more important to this Australia-US-China limbo than, say, the previous political issues?
Well, I think it depends on how we judge what Donald Trump does. Mm. And I think we have to, take a position which we feel is better from a global and a general humanitarian point of view.
And Hans Hendrischke, what do you see as the biggest, dangers for Australia with the trade relationship we have at the moment?
Well, I think the biggest danger is on the political side. That mm-hmm. there's some political instability, or that trade relations get affected by politics. As long as we keep the two separate and focus on our trade, we will actually be in a very strong position, because we don't have any of the problems that the United States has with China. We have a trade surplus. We are in our industries where we are strong. We are very strong. We have a good complementary relationship in agriculture, where there's big demand, healthcare, all of these areas we are really strong, and we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, we're going to agriculture.
Yeah, let's draw on that agriculture point. I want to direct this question now to you, James. One sector that has attracted great interest from the Chinese is definitely agriculture. They're very fond of Australian food and, of course, consumption-based services. What are the prime interest areas of Chinese investment in this country?
In agriculture, we're really seeing it across the board. I mean, beef and dairy obviously jump out. But, you know, the Chinese investment follows where the Chinese consumer is going. So you're seeing this massive increase in the Chinese middle class. And for me, that's the standout statistic. 850 million more Chinese entering the middle class by 2030. That's what academic research says. So Chinese investors see that demand. Obviously, they want to be part of that. And one of the best ways they can do that is by investing in Australia. Good for us, too, because, you know, we earn tax revenues from those companies. We earn export dollars from them. And, of course, we get jobs in Australia, not in China.
So beyond that positivity there, obviously, the enlarging middle class, do you think Australia's reputation as a clean food producer, if not the best in the world, is the main reason that the Chinese are so interested in our agriculture?
Yeah, I think that's one of the clean, green, right? That's our reputation and we're good at it. I'd just be a bit careful, though. When it was in the mining boom, we were lucky because we can dig iron ore up out of the ground much cheaper than anyone else. That's just a natural advantage. When it comes to agriculture, we've got some pretty strong competitors, including those folks just across the road in New Zealand. Beef, for example, is an industry we should be really good at, and we are good at it. But let me tell you, the last 18 months, our beef sales to China have actually been falling by double-digit numbers. Now, one reason is increased competition from other countries. Another reason is we simply don't have enough supply in Australia. So there's two areas that we need to address.
Vic, I want to go to you now. Just drawing off some research here, the McKinsey Global Institute has found that the confluence of globalization, urbanization, technology, and aging population has seen a doubling of productivity in China in just 12 years. On that, Vic, should we feel complacent about Australia's export success?
I think that that's a fairly complex issue. One is that whilst those are the figures for China, China has been making a very deliberate effort to switch from being export-oriented to having a situation where they are mainly consumption-driven and more like a normal economy. That hasn't happened as quickly as they expected. Part of it is due to the global financial crisis, but in part, I think people got their estimates wrong. Many people originally thought that the turning point between switching from being export-oriented to being consumption-driven was around about 2011. But now the estimates are going out to about 2018 to 2020. So they're still quite strongly export-oriented. And also, China did not manage too well to try and get its own investors to switch from you could say residential housing and investment in the housing sector to the stock market. In fact, it did very, very poorly. And that's simply because people in China do not know how to read the stock exchange. They've always taken stocks and shares to be driven by government announcements. And when the government didn't make the announcement and when the government thought that people should be looking at the market itself, it didn't work. And so May, I think, the 7th in two years ago, there was an enormous collapse and the stock market has never really taken off well in China.
And a lot of people thought that that was one of the reasons why money started moving towards markets like us in Australia for investment in real estate, for example.
That's certainly a part of it. The other part of it is that the Chinese have always been a little bit troubled by their situation in China. They know from past history that governments are very fragile and that their own position within their economy is fragile. So most people sought to have PR in a country like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, USA, or the EU. And part of that is to also secure some residential property, but it also reflects the fact that in the 10 or 12 years that you were saying, their incomes rose enormously and their savings rose enormously. Now, that's part of government policy as well, because many people who were, say, the leaders of the types of SOEs, government industries, that they decided to privatize, they made those leaders the owners of those properties, and they became wealthy very quickly.
All right, well, we'll just take a quick break there. You're listening to On the Money from 2SER FM here in Sydney on the Community Radio Network.
Mm-hmm. My name is François Carrière. I am at the UTS Business School, and you are listening to On the Money, summing up finance in one easy bite.
And welcome back. I'm Hans Lee, along here with Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On The Money, broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. If you have just joined us, welcome. It is the Australia-China Investment Special this week, and on the panel we have Professor James Lawrenson of the Australia-China Relations Institute, Vic Edwards, a visiting fellow at the University of New South Wales Business School, and Professor Hans Hendrischke, the author of the new report, Demystifying Chinese Investment in Australia. Professor Lawrenson, I want to start this session with you. You've just been on a panel discussing the Belt and Road Initiative. Will this be intrinsic to the success for Australia's trade future, and how should we be involved in it?
Look, it's a good initiative from Australia's perspective, because one of the great developments in the region over the last two decades has been that tariffs have fallen a lot, right? So that's a good thing for Australian exporters. But one thing that hasn't changed much at all is all the other costs associated with trade. And a big part of that, for example, is transportation. And part of the reason for that is just bad infrastructure in Australia and in the region generally. Now, most of our exports go north to Asia. So, if the Belt and Road Initiative is about improving connectivity, and in particular infrastructure in the region, to the extent that it can do that, that's a good thing for Australia.
Vic, Professor Hendrischke, do you share that same sentiment?
I would go perhaps even a little bit further. But originally we had what was called the Ord River Project up in the Northern Territory. And that failed not because the actual irrigation scheme was poor. It in fact showed very good cost-benefit type ratio. But there were absolutely no transportation routes anywhere. So you had something stuck very near Darwin with not a good rail link down to South Australia, and you had no harbour that you could ship things to Asia, etc. Now, what's happened recently is that a Chinese company called Zhongfu has bought that for virtually the cost of arid land. And they are repairing all the channels, and they are getting it operating again. Now, at the same time, you have the port of Darwin being given a 99-year lease to China. So you don't have to be, you know, a mathematical genius to link the two together. I think that China is looking for food security as one of its main stays, and I think that Australia has to look at that. But Australia also has to look at what it gets out of some of these things, and I think that that's a crucial point. I think I would agree with James on almost everything he said.
And so is it really important for China's future, the One Belt, One Road, Professor Hendrischke? Do you think that is going to be their major thrust in the upcoming years?
Well, it's certainly going to be important for China in the sense that it's the way in which China globalizes. They do that regionally. They move step by step. They expand the areas where they have economic influence. So rather than focusing on the whole rule-based infrastructure, the regulatory infrastructure, they relate mainly to infrastructure that they can control through economic processes. But the other point, really, it is important for Australia. And it's not a matter so much of saying this is Australia versus China and it relates to the two. It's a global trend. Infrastructure is becoming globalized, and more than we see. Power is becoming global. At the Internet of Things is reaching to power. Port facilities are a global business. They're not a national business anymore. So we are in the middle of a trend, and sometimes we tend to tell ourselves that we are very special and that something extraordinary is happening to us, whereas in fact we are part of a global trend and we participate in that as much as all the neighbouring countries do.
Just quickly on that, our major ports, so you know, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, perhaps, how does that fit in with the One Belt, One Road?
Well, ports are obviously a major part of transportation infrastructure. So we know that a Chinese company has the lease to operate Darwin Port. And can I just add, while we worry, we hear a lot of fears about that investment in Canberra and Sydney and Melbourne, if you ask the folks of Darwin what they think of that Chinese investment, you'll get a very, very positive response because they see the jobs, they see the expansion of the port, and they see the trade opportunities through exporting more beef and other products out of Darwin. But some others, Chinese investments have gone under the radar. There was a US company that bought a 40% share of the Port of Melbourne last year, which is Australia's biggest, busiest port. If you look at that US company, actually half of their capital for that investment came from China. So this is what I think we're talking about. It's not just the globalisation of the ports, it's a globalisation of the funding behind the ports as well.
I want to draw on this then. Talking about funding coming from all different sources and as such, we've been talking here about the benefits of the Belt and Road Initiative. Professor Hendryshka, I want to address this question to you, then I'll open the floor. Even though it is all positive, as we can see, particularly for the people of Darwin, surely there are inherent risks here, if not for Darwin or Sydney, for the rest of Australia. Are there any?
Well, you could always argue there are commercial risks because the Developing Australia's North is a project at the moment. It's an initiative. The infrastructure is not there, so that's going to be built up. Then, of course, there are the political risk in the sense which was made clear in the sense that the United States has views about that. And so it's a question of finding a balance there and weighing up the economic benefits and the long-term commercial benefits with other considerations and what we have to take into account when we deal with our allies.
I think that we sometimes think of Belt and Road policy as being relatively recent, but China actually started it maybe some 30 years ago. It, for example, went to Africa, and we sometimes think that their exploitation of oil and minerals and things in Africa were, you know, something that was a little bit of a luck thing, but it wasn't. They've worked at it very hard. They've developed ports there. They've, in fact, put in Africa, in India, in a number of other countries. They've put in the, for example, very fast trains. And there's a proposal that they do it for Australia, but we've rejected that so far.
So if this started some 30 years ago, why do you think President Xi has now really put this on the pedal and said it's now time to really
because it
this.
Was never at that stage thought of as a Belt and Road type policy, but it was actually a strong policy that was operational. Now that China has become a very strong and you could say the number two trading and perhaps global power in the world, is that it seems appropriate that he actually says we have a plan and we are going to go global. And I think that globalization is a fact of life in our present generation. But there are many other things that are also going to go in with globalization.
Yeah, and we should also not overvalue what we read in the press about the president having said something about one or another company. Over 50% of all Chinese investment in Australia is done by Chinese companies who are already here. So it's companies who have a track record here, they've worked here, they know what they're doing, and they're reinvesting. And if then out of those few hundred projects we have and over 200 companies, the Chinese president said this one or the other one have to be careful with their investment or have to do more due diligence, that's not kind of hitting the brake pedal. That's.
I meant to hit the acceleration pedal that they've had so much of this now.
Not even that. The United States or Chinese investment into the United States last year grew 200%. We grew 11%. European Union grew 77%. Again, we are with 11%. We are going very steadily and modestly.
James Lawrence, I just thought I'd ask quickly here if you're aware of anything. I know President Xi's very interested in trains. He's well known for his interest in trains. Has there been any discussions, you know, for Australia? We often talk about very fast trains. It's a government initiative people bring up when they're in political trouble. can we draw on something there? Has the Chinese got something for us, do you think?
Well, I tell you what, if there was going to be... Now, look, I can't comment on the business case for very high-speed rail in Australia, okay? I really don't know. But if it stacks up, right, I couldn't think of a better partner than China. I mean, if you look at how China has transformed its domestic economy, its domestic geography through high-speed rail over the last 10 years, it's just phenomenal. Even the technology of their trains, as far as I know, it's as good as Japan's and Germany's. And we know China has a very strong interest in infrastructure, and they're like Australia too. So you put all that together, and if the business case stacks up, China's there waiting to partner, I'm sure.
Because, I mean, I think the plan is to put train tracks all the way through the stands, through the old trade route, the Silk Road, all the way through to the Baltic, is it, I think?
Yeah, well, it's...
Rotterdam, for that matter.
Yes. Rotterdam, yeah. It's a long way. It's a long way, isn't it?
And they're going to, in fact, put the train straight through to London.
Ah.
So that's the proposal already. But I think that, you know, what you've got there is a partner that... has the capital, has the know-how, and certainly can complete these things very quickly, because all you've got to do is to have a look at South Africa. They partnered with the main bank in South Africa originally, and then they provided the funding through that bank. So really, it's still coming from China, but the railway line there, the fast train, was developed there. And I feel that if South Africa can do it, we could certainly do it. I think it's really more a political issue again. Since the 1960s, we've had proposals to have the very fast train, and it hasn't happened for many, many reasons. But it is definitely possible.
Yes. Well, look, I'm afraid we're just about out of time here. So I'd like to thank you all three of you for being on the money. Really appreciate you being on here, James Lawrenson, Professor Hendrischka, Hans Hendrischka, and Vic Edwards, talking about the Australia-Chinese trade relationship. Hans, do you want to take us out on the show? I'll bring up the music.
All right.
So. Where is that music? There it is.
It's when you're giving an on-air up, folks.
Yes, there we go. Three. I think that should be it, shouldn't it?
Please explain.
No, that wasn't it. This happens sometimes.
This is live panelling, folks.
Very
in the live.
There we go. There we go. All right. So you're listening to On the Money, broadcast from the studios of Radio 2 SERFM in Sydney. I'm Roger Chambers, and Hans. Tell us a bit about looking up On the Money on the internet.
Absolutely. We obviously thank Professor Lawrence and Professor Hendrischka and Vic for joining us tonight. We are produced at the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all our shows and stories online, 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook as well. Just search at On the Money 2SER. Run.
Yes, thank you all for being here. Is there anything you'd like to say, just a bit of summary on going out here? Professor Hendrischka, what do you think about the future for Australia's trade?
I think Australia is going to do very well because we're already doing better year by year.
Ms. Lawrenson?
Let me give you one statistic. Last 12 months, we exported $95 billion worth of goods to China. That is higher than in the middle of the mining boom. So the mining boom's over, but we're still doing very well from China trade.
Thank you. And Vic Edwards.
And I think that the direction is going up and up still upon that. It's not, as some people say, that China will have a soft landing or something like that. I think that it will go ahead, and our exports to them will be very good.
All right. Well, thank you all again for being here. It's been On the Money here at 2SERFM, going out on the Community Radio Network.
Get your shake of the sauce bottle.
Hi, I'm Jeff Field, 2SER's news director. After almost three decades covering news in Sydney, I'm proud to be leading a team of eager young journalists bringing you Sydney's only independent news service, not influenced by commercial or government interests. Whether it's local, national or international, 2SER will cover the main stories without fear or favour, weekday mornings every half hour from 6 till midday and when news breaks. So tune in for News with a Difference, 2SER 107.3.
In the House, cult film classics return to Event Cinemas George Street, August 11. The heat is on in the film that introduced Eddie Murphy's comedy gold to the world, Beverly Hills Cop.
Disturbing the peace, I got thrown out of a window. What's the f***ing charge for getting pushed out of a moving car, huh? Jaywalking?
Hosted by Seven's Jabba and Quinny from Supernova. Check the full In the House program and grab tickets at eventcinemas.com.au. Event Cinemas George Street, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.